The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Now let's turn our attention to growth dynamics outside of the United States. We're very happy to welcome Lena Komaleva on the Ring Central phone line. Lena, of course, of G Plus Economics. We have a central bank meeting in Japan tomorrow and then next week in Europe and also the United States. But this morning, Lena, we got some UK growth figures and it wasn't quite as bad as forecast. The UK did manage to avoid a triple dip, but the trend around the world is pretty clear, growth weakening.
Hi, Vonnie. Great to be with you. And yes, you're absolutely right. Although I think outside the US, it's probably the no growth figures. So this morning's figures in the UK weren't as bad. The heart of the panic, if you like, was about a triple dip recession that didn't materialize. But the reality is that the UK is having a very modern kind of a recession by simply being in a subtrend growth for a very long period of time. In fact, the UK has been the worst performing major economy after Italy since the 2008 crash in terms of growth. So there's nothing really to rejoice about here. We're not seeing any fantastic momentum that means that the economy is about to turn the corner. But in fact, the imbalances preventing growth resuming in the UK are very much symptomatic of the debate that we heard so much about from the G20 at the weekend, the IMF and the World Bank meetings in Washington. And it's a debate that's not very dissimilar to what's happening on Capitol Hill as well.
Yes, indeed. It seems to be a global theme right now. How much is the UK a case apart, though, Lena? It seems to be less intertwined, at least in the consciousness of, the public, than, say, a country like Spain or Italy.
It seems to be indeed, simply because the contagion from the Eurozone crisis has been down to the possibility over the last 3 years of a disorderly default and another Lehman event. Now, this is the UK does face some risks, but nowhere near that, and the risks of UK growth underperforming aren't really that impactful in terms of global growth. The Eurozone, of course, is a very big part of the global trade cycle, and therefore it does have an impact on what's happening in the US and in on export and manufacturer service in China as well.
Well, speaking of Europe, Spanish and Italian bonds particularly have been supported in recent days to a surprising extent. What's behind this?
Yes, I think that, well, there are two things really behind them. There's one of them, or rather three. One of them is the expectation that the ECB may be nearing another rate cut, which will be a rather good event, but it's a very high-risk event. The market is split, not evenly, but it is split, and there's quite a bit of uncertainty stemming from the various comments from ECB Governing Council officials, none of which have really been specific enough to convince that the ECB is indeed close to reaching a consensus. And let's not forget, the ECB is a federal kind of a central bank, but unlike the Fed, it does not, its decision making is quite non-transparent, and it tends to agree on rate moves by consensus. So the justification has been there for the ECB to cut rates since late last year, if not earlier, but the fact that we haven't seen the rate cut. So one of the things supporting bonds is the expectation the ECB may be preparing another rate cut. Another expectation is that, well, tail risks of contagion from Italy, from the Italian political situation, from the Slovenian banking situation, from the rather messy Cyprus bailout, haven't really materialized. So without any near-term major shocks around the corner expected in terms of Eurozone capital markets credit, the markets have just gone back to employing the vast amounts of central bank cash they are in the system into locking yield, the yield grab trade, as I call it. And the third thing... Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, the third thing, yeah?
Well, the third thing is that... Well, the growth figures in the Eurozone are absolutely dire. Mm. Domestic banks in Spain, in Italy, are deleveraging, and that de-risking of the bank's balance sheet is by default targeting domestic savings into government bonds rather than riskier loans to households or businesses than the domestic economies, yeah.
Well, let's take number two for a second. You said that the fears, from the Slovenian banking situation haven't really materialised. Also, Portugal... Thing is, it's a kind of a virtual cycle, right? Because the reason you know that they're materializing is because it's in the bond market. You can see it reflected in the bond market. And if the bond market isn't reflecting it, then nothing is materializing.
That's a very interesting point. So I see. Well, the Eurozone is in a self-fulfilling crisis to the extent that growth has collapsed as a response to the over leveraging of banks and the credit crunch. The fact that the system reached the point at which it could no longer peripheral sovereigns could no longer fund themselves freely in international capital markets. It's not a dissimilar anatomy of the crisis to the one that we saw, the global crisis of 2008-2009. The very fact that because yields are falling, it would appear that indeed the risk of a disorderly default scenario has diminished. It is indeed in some way creating a sort of a reverse circularity, but I wouldn't go as far as calling it a. I wouldn't be as optimistic, Vonnie, as suggesting this is some kind of a positive feedback loop, because none of this dynamics, none of this liquidity trap, really, in the financial system is having any benefit for the Eurozone real economies or for the actual real default risks in Eurozone peripheral markets.
Well, I suppose the bottom line then is, will the ECB cut rates May 2nd, Lina?
Goodness. Well, that's what we all want to know. And there are very good reasons why they should. And then there are some good reasons why they haven't already, and they may not as early as May. It's not a linear argument, which is perhaps not surprising, given that the federalist structure of the ECB is one thing, and the other thing is the divergent geographic economies sharing the euro. So it's extremely difficult for the ECB to reach a consensus, as it would be appropriate for a conglomerate of independent sovereign states, when the geographic economies within the monetary union are as different as Spain and Germany are at the moment.
So now let's return to our guest. We're speaking with Lina Komaleva of G7 Economics, and she is in Britain. She doesn't have much of a commute, though, because we're on the Ring Central phone line with Lina.
Lina, yes, and it's quite a nice weather here as well, Vonnie.
Yes, here too, Lina. Things are improving. Not so much, though, for the global economy. Is Germany slowing materially?
Is Germany slowing materially? Mm. Yes, Germany appears to be slowing down. What's been interesting is the microeconomic anecdotal sort of grassroots evidence, the bottom-up evidence that often gets submitted by economists. But I mean here the German car manufacturers' results and announcements in recent days, which signal that although Germany is doing relatively better than its neighbors and many of them, major economies, it is still suffering from weaker demand in the Eurozone and from competitive pressures in parts of the world, faster-growing parts of the world, such as Latin America. So it would appear that Germany is indeed losing gear, and more importantly, it's certainly not generating sufficient growth to outweigh the contractionary austerity and credit crunch that we see in the rest of the Eurozone.
Well, is it a myth that the rest of the Eurozone really needs Germany, or is that some kind of truth? Do they need Germany to sort of pull them up by the bootstraps?
Well, Germany is important because it is the collapse to record lows in German 10-year yields this month that helps reduce, that helped create an anchor to lower rates for peripheral economies such as Spain and Italy. So that's important. I think that Germany is a benchmark of credibility for the region, institutionally, in financial terms, in economic terms. There is another thing, however, the aspect that I think perhaps has been overlooked until now is that it's not so much of whether the Eurozone needs Germany, but can the Eurozone afford to lose Germany now? And the reality is this. Whether Germany likes it or not, the rest of the Eurozone will default into Germany on either of the two scenarios possible. That is, the Eurozone staying together, in which case Germany will probably have to suffer some seriously serious default risks in the form of haircuts on official loans extended to peripheral economies, which are, let's face it, not going to generate the kind of growth needed to repay these loans in future, or in the second scenario of the Eurozone breaking up, in which case Germany will have to suffer huge haircuts through the exchange rates of devaluing currencies in its periphery.
Yeah, not a good situation, all told, if something like that were to happen, I suppose. But even with the extension of loans that we saw for Portugal and Ireland, I mean, is that enough to sort of keep those economies at least on track?
Yes, well, that would be the hope. And the reality is Ireland in particular has been doing fantastically well. Portugal is also doing well. One metric, time-tested metrics that the IMF used to use with emerging markets, which I used to cover in a past life up until 10 years ago, hoping in the last decade that I'll never see another major global crisis, and here we are, is that both countries have been able to get back into, to some extent, to fund themselves in capital markets. Ireland and Portugal have made some successful placements, have managed to roll over some maturities in with private investors, and that's a good thing. Are these economies, however, anywhere near able to stand on their own two feet? The very fact that they needed an extension for their official loans suggested that indeed they needed an upgrade in their credit stance with private sector creditors, as in there won't be any, you know, sovereign liquidity siphoning into official creditors at the expense of private sector creditors. In order to be able to fund themselves in favorable terms in the market.
So, in fact, both countries got quite a long extension, right? 7 years.
7 years, which I think, in actual fact, I mean, yes, it, on the one hand, it shows that the economies did need further help because of this generous extension. But it also shows, of course, the level of reintegration and compliance, sovereign compliance, and trust, indeed, there is from official creditors in these economies in their ability to rehabilitate themselves after the banking crash. The problem, however, of course, is that for the Eurozone to be able to function healthily, it has to be able to function healthily as a whole. As we saw up until just a couple of weeks ago with Cyprus, there's still moments where the Eurozone is only as strong as its weakest link. And the contagion, the network, the economic neighborhood, our problems aren't going to disappear until we get growth back.
Well, Lina, you say that we're seeing a modicum of confidence, at least in the sovereigns in Europe on the part of investors, but could it also be a case of, well, there's not much else to do, there's nowhere else to go?
Well, there is nowhere obvious to go at the moment, but there's a very strong argument that the Eurozone cannot possibly stay where it is right now. I mean, just to look at the unemployment figures, the French and Spanish unemployment figures that we're getting today, Spanish figures came out this morning. French unemployment has been growing for the past 21 months at 3.2 million. It's the highest it's been in 14 years. In Spain, the overall unemployment rate is at over 25%. The youth unemployment rate, which used to be 50%, so one of every two young people unemployed, is now 57%. And these figures are getting worse because growth projections are being revised down. So to put this into perspective for American listeners, the U.S. unemployment rate peaked at 9.9% back in December 2009. The broader measure of underemployment, which includes the conventional unemployment measure plus people working part-time for economic reasons, that peaked at 17%. So,
Lina, will there come a point? Yeah. I mean, when you think about, you know, every second young person you meet in Spain being unemployed, and even more than that now, will there come a point where the ECB does something about this? This is storing up problems in every sector of the economy, from healthcare to social security, for generations to come, isn't it?
It's such an important point. Absolutely. I mean, these are societies. Ireland was the first economy to actually get into an austerity, and they've done everything by the economic textbook. Forget about the European Commission. They have done everything that's considered to be credible and good for the long-term health of the economy. Yet, even in Ireland, workers are not yet reaping the benefits. So, absolutely, the labor figures carry the tagline of depression-era economics, and they create the risk of a Japan-style growth trap, because the combination of chronic youth unemployment and you know, weaker labor incomes, plus rising pension deficits and the deflationary pressures from falling wages. All of this is a constellation of factors that is quite unfavorable because it creates preferences among consumers to save for the rainy day, rainier tomorrow, rather than spend for today. Optimism surveys, economic confidence surveys are once again on a decline. So unemployment is by far the most important challenge facing the Eurozone governments, given that growth is not just the key to overcoming the Eurozone crisis, it is ensuring that the Eurozone can survive its current unity. Now, your question was really about what the ECB should do, if we have time.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I'm very happy to go into it. Well, there are three factors that are important and that the ECB must consider next week. First of all, of course, the Eurozone has not been growing since the third quarter of 2011. Now, that's an awfully long time. The latest producer surveys show us that expectations for recovery this year aren't going to materialize. So with the output gap deepening, with unemployment set to rise further and disinflationary pressures rising as a result of all this, the ECB has really got no excuse to keep rates where they are. The refi rate at 0.75% is about 1.5 percentage points higher than it should be based on just growth and unemployment projections and inflation projections in the Eurozone. The second thing is that a rate cut will do absolutely nothing, unfortunately, to help growth in the Eurozone, but it will help somewhat to reduce recessionary pressures. And that's not because there's really any good chance of a cut supporting any form of credit growth in the periphery, but it will do two things that will help. First of all, it will reduce negative pressures on banks' profitability along the periphery, which will help their efforts to recapitalize themselves, and which will be necessary to end this crisis. And the second thing is it will also, by virtue of that, reduce the implicit government liability, as in the need for governments to step in as a lender of last resort.
Are you saying, Lina, that in some ways it's in fact going to be the European banks that are going to be the saviors here?
I think that the recapitalization of the European banking system, it will be essential to end the crisis in the real economies, yes. It's not a similar dynamic to the one we saw back in the global economy, in the US, in the UK, back in 2007, 2008, when it was the bank credit crunch that crippled otherwise healthy-looking economies.
Well, what about the lending schemes that are being sort of set up in Europe for small businesses? Will small businesses not be able to contribute a bit here?
Yes. Well, the small businesses are the ones that are most dependent on bank credit. And for that reason, they've been worst hit. This has been the global financial recovery since 2009. It's really been very much a two-tier recovery because we've seen beyond capital markets with the help of liquidity created by central banks. Within the traditional banking space, the banking system in the Eurozone is shrinking. In fact, the combination of no quantitative easing from the ECB and fiscal austerity along the periphery, as well as the politically incentivized sort of delays with bank recapitalization, because of course bank recapitalization means an immediate charge on public sector balance sheets and an implicit charge on taxpayers, a hugely socially unpopular thing at this time.
We're going to have to take up the conversation another time, Lina, but you're saying the ECB really has no excuse to keep rates where they are next week, and a cut would reduce recessionary pressure. Thanks to Lina Komaleva.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.